Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back, and we are into the top 20 of our favorite 100 movies of all time. It is episode number 81, and tonight we are discussing Good Will Hunting and a movie that I will not call by its entire name that John has typed out there out of spite, but it is The End of Evangelion, which, by the way, John, probably my favorite thing to learn how to say, because I definitely thought this was called Evangelion entire time that it existed and the entire time that it was showing up on your list. But those are the two movies we're talking about. One is an anime and the other is a movie people have seen. John, how are you feeling about this?
I'm feeling great. Like, these movies somehow just thematically really work well together.
They do.
Great couple of movies. I made you watch an entire anime so we could talk about this movie. So that's an accomplishment unto itself. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling good.
Yeah, I watched the entire anime series and I didn't hate it nearly as much as I was thought I was going to. For anybody who's been listening to this since the beginning, you'll know that I was not a fan of Akira. Pretty thought it was pretty boring. Really, this is just a genre that doesn't do anything for me for the most part. And that's where it's always hard when it comes to something like this, right? It's similar to how I feel with a lot of newer musicals. They just don't do it for me. So am I going to go see it? If I'm going to go see a Marvel movie, I'm not going to sit down and watch a Marvel movie because I know I'm not going to like that movie. So anime is not something that I really seek out, even though I really like the Studio Ghibli movies. I don't really view that so much as anime as that's just animation. And John has dropped out. So now I have to somehow continue to have a conversation about Evangelion, which is going to be pretty much impossible for me because I don't really know enough about these movies. But I guess it's better John's gone anyway because now I can talk a little bit of trash about it. But here he is. He's back. Maybe. John, is that just your internet just saying F you to both of us?
Yeah, pretty much. I think we should be good now.
Okay, we'll see. And if we're not, everybody remember, we're blaming John, who also made me watch the entirety of Evangelion. But what I was saying, John, was that while this genre normally doesn't do anything for me, and while I don't really consider Studio Ghibli in this genre, because Studio Ghibli is more of animation, I feel like anime has a very specific, like, here is voiceover over a still shot that, you know, is just, we see that a lot in anime. Just different style. But I actually quite enjoyed Evangelion, even though I wasn't really into the first couple episodes of the show. And by couple, I mean like first 15, where it's kind of a monster of the week kind of thing. But once it starts getting into the meaning of everything and the meaning of humanity, and it gets into all the stuff with Rey and everything, like, congratulations, they did it. That's all I'll say about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's like one of the big things with Ava that like attracts people to it is this anime really tricks people into liking it. Mm-hmm. By posing it as this mecha anime, which is like this popular genre of animes, and then it's actually just this existential story of people with fully fleshed out characters relating to each other. And then we get into this first movie, the end of Evangelion, and the interesting thing about this movie, I don't know how much you know about this series from a production standpoint, but
I know he got death threats and he put them in the movie.
Yes. So Hideaki Anno is a genius. I love all of his work. He was incredibly depressed while he was making this series. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, you can see that. You can see that by the themes that are in the... He was going through some severe depression. Also, they ran out of money to make the show. Mm-hmm. That's why we get the bonkers episode 25 and 26, which is all weird animation styles. We don't get any massive end conflict in the series, and people hated it,
which is funny because I actually kind of liked it.
I personally think that ending is better than the end of Evangelion.
I felt that way until episode 26 of End of Evangelion started. Pretty much the last 10 minutes of episode 25 into 26, I was like, okay, this is better than the show. But I did enjoy the show, and I was surprised that I liked it because I had heard so much bad about it. And I'm like, okay, bad anime, a genre I already don't like, there's no way I'm going to like this.
Well, and that's what it comes down to, is like the end of Evangelion is Anno's FU to the people who didn't appreciate the original ending for this series.
Yeah.
And it's really weird because essentially we get this time between the end of episode 24. So Shinji has just killed Kuaru, and, you know, instrumentality is starting and stuff, but we don't see that in the original anime. And instead, we get just like straight into instrumentality and everything goes wild. But End of Evangelion kind of branches that, where we get the end of episode 24 up until human instrumentality starts. And then we get like what happens right after human instrumentality at the very end of the film. And it's so bizarre because Anno still kind of keeps that really, the last like 45 minutes of this movie are wild. Yeah. It's just all this massive, like there's a bunch of Christian symbiology and like we're talking massive philosophical questions of what it means to be a person, what it means to be an individual, who are you? And this movie means so much to me. And I mean, this is a very personal film for me. The first time I watched, and I kind of cheated with putting this on my list because it really does stand in place for the entire series of Evangelion.
Thanks for making me watch the whole thing, John. You selfish bastard. But anyway.
There are four more movies you could watch afterwards, which
I actually probably will. That's the crazy thing. I actually probably will, and I didn't think I'd be saying that after this.
And that's the crazy thing about Evangelion is that, like, an end of Evangelion on my list. I don't know when I remake my top 100 if End of Evangelion is still on the list, because I think the last movie that we had to wait like 13 years to come out was better than End of Evangelion. And like, I don't know. I have to tackle that eventually, but as a whole, this series hit me. My first time watching this series was the perfect time to watch this very reflective series, pondering like purpose in life and just like your relationships with people. I watched this for the first time right after my youngest sister died, as I'm going through a divorce and my dream career of being a teacher is kind of crumbling around me, and I'm realizing it's not what I want to do. So I'm already at this place in my life where I am questioning what is my purpose? Why am I driving? And I feel like Shinji in this moment, where it's like I'm isolated, I'm living up north, I don't really have many people around me, I'm kind of shutting people off because I don't really want to talk to them. And I feel like my purpose is just like being this teacher. And then like, what am I without that? And I was going through this exact same experience as Shinji, just without the like terrible father. And it just hit me so hard. And End of Evangelion manages to take the mecha aspect of the series and combine it with the philosophical aspect of the series in such a beautiful way.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand where you're coming from with that, because I feel like this would be such a heavy movie to watch if you're in a heavy type of mood, which I wasn't in when watching this, but definitely one of those movies that gets you thinking on a deeper level, which is what the show doesn't do for me early on, and it starts to take a little bit to get into that with, and I'm going to butcher names all night, but Rei Ayanami is the best, one of the best names in anything ever. Rei Ayanami just rolls right off the freaking tongue. That's good. But you have Shinji, you have Asaka. How do you say it? Asuka? Okay. Ass kicker. But anyway, so we have them. And when it starts getting into their like deaths and Misato and all of that, it starts getting into why Rei existed. The birth of Nerve is really when I said, okay, like let's do it. I'm ready for this kind of thing. I never watched the entire show, but it almost felt to me a little bit like Fringe. I don't know if you ever watched Fringe. Mm-hmm. Did you ever watch that show?
I didn't finish it. Yeah.
Yeah. Fringe kind of starts off as like okay, every week this is going to happen. And you know, it's a serial. And then all of a sudden it starts to branch out. And you start to say, oh, wow, okay, now it's becoming a little bit more like Lost. And this felt like, okay, yeah, we're following Shinji's storyline and we're following Misato's storyline, but we're not really watching all that much happen, because every time an angel shows up and they just have to kill it. And once you get into those last six episodes, and it is, I think 21 is the birth of Nerve.
Yeah.
Those last six episodes are great, because it just feels like, okay, there's really something going on here. And all of those questions at the end, and you know, even if people don't like it, but all of those questions of what are you afraid of? What do you fear? This, that, whatever. And we start getting into Asuka's background and we get into all that. I thought that was great. But what the movie, I didn't like the first 15 minutes of the movie, when you just have like the people coming in with the guns and they're just shooting everybody. I felt like that was just out of absolute nowhere. It didn't really make sense. Didn't need to be there, but felt like kind of what you had said, mech anime, right? Super popular genre. Now we have these cool badass things kind of making this like a cyberpunk kind of thing, which is what people want to watch. But as soon as it gets into Misato and we start getting into Shinji with his flashbacks and all of that, and that bleeds into episode 26 and everything that happens in episode 26 with the giant Rei and Rei like dissolving, and the part where they're sitting on top of each other, and we're at that point now where I don't know where bodies begin and where they end. It could come across as so cliche, and we'll be talking about that with Good Will Hunting in a little bit, because that's another movie that could come across so cliche, but it just goes to show that when it's done right, it really works. And one of my favorite things that Evangelion did were the seizure inducing montages, essentially. Those are epic, and those really work, because it gets you into that chaotic sense. How does a show where there would be clips of a penguin standing there for over a minute and a half at a time while two people argued above him and you don't see the people at all and the penguin doesn't move, how does that show, that same show, have a chaotic sequence of, oh my God, I'm in Shinji's brain, or I'm in Rei's brain, or I'm in Asuka's brain, or I'm in Misato's brain? How does it do that? And I think that was what was so impressive. And I don't say this about anime often because I don't think that it actually applies, but the last 20 minutes are downright beautiful. The visuals, everything, are gorgeous. And it is so unbelievably impressive what they were able to pull off with not much of a budget. You see at the beginning of this movie, all the people who were involved in this, that's because they literally wouldn't have made this movie if they didn't have about 35 different financiers behind them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's really interesting taking where the end of Evangelion falls in like the series as a whole, because I think this anime is one of the most cinematic animes we ever got. I think there are some shots in this that you've seen in live action films that resonate with you because they are shot as if, a lot of the times in anime, you kind of get these like weird perspectives where it's like very like character oriented. Mm-hmm. The way the end of Evangelion is really drawn is in a way where it feels like it's still just a live action movie that has been animated.
Yeah. Well, and it also, why do you think they put in the clips of real people? And don't give me, if you know the production reason, don't give me that. Why do you think they made that artistic decision?
I think it's to kind of relate it to the audience itself. It's to make it, it's to put you into this space where it gives you that moment where you're just like, wait, why is this live action all of a sudden? Why are we in a movie theater? Now here's the reflection. Because we've spent this entire movie up to this point with Shinji reflecting on who he is, and with Misato reflecting on who she is, Asuka, like coming up with how she feels about who she is, and then you have this point where it's just like Shinji's creating worlds. We know Shinji's creating worlds at this point in his mind, and we get this movie theater, and it's so introspective at that point where you just are forced to reflect on all of these themes this movie has and how they apply to you.
Yeah, no. Okay. I mean, I think that's interesting because, you know, to bring us out like that after we hadn't seen anything like that, I think it's a really strong decision, whether it works or not. It's a very strong decision. It's going for it in one way or another. And I wasn't sure how I felt about it. And I really didn't like, I think that's as good an explanation as any. I want to think more on it as to what I actually think it all means. But, you know, at the time, why are we doing this? But I do love all the voiceover over that. And, you know, the voiceover decisions in this show were really well done. And in this movie, especially, they're really well done because sometimes that's like the least, like in Akira, you know, sometimes the dialogue in these types of animes and stuff just drive me insane. And I didn't feel that way when watching this show. Every now and then when Asuka opened her mouth, I wanted to, you know, cover my ears. But I also think that has a lot to do with the fact that that's just the voice actor from her character. And that's just what it's going to be. I was into pretty much everything in this movie, which I wasn't sure I was going to be. Even the fact that there's credits in the middle of the movie. Because it's really not a movie, even if John wants to call it a movie, you know, it's only like half of a movie pretty much, but there's credits in the middle that spin like DNA. And that's a really interesting decision.
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially a movie, but it has this like breakpoint, and you can even see it in the title cards because it gives us the title cards because this is episode 25 Prime and episode 26 Prime. Again, this is Anno just saying F you to everyone who didn't like the original ending of the series. And Anno finally had the budget to complete his series with Thrice Upon a Time, which is the end of the rebuild quadrilogy. And like you can tell that is how he wanted the series to end. And it feels, like I said, that's kind of part of why it feels better than this film. But that movie didn't come out when we made our top 100s. It came out after that.
Yeah. No, and that's fair. I will say one thing, and as you keep talking about it, one thing that I'm not a fan of, and I've never been a fan of it, and it drives me crazy now, are these kind of like redos that people do. You know, we saw it with The Godfather Part 3. We see it with Star Wars, with Who Shot First and all that stuff. I hate when filmmakers do this. Now, I understand the reasoning behind this one, but I think part of the thing that keeps me away sometimes from Now I'll never watch Marvel movies because it's just too late. Like, forget it. It's not worth it. Now I have to go watch the Disney Plus series, the Marvel movie. I got to watch the Christmas special. I got to watch everything just to understand a 2.5 hour movie. Make your movie better so I can understand it anyway. And I think whenever I would see End of Evangelion, right, it would pop up on Best Animated Movies Ever. It would pop up on Letterboxd. It would pop up on all this stuff. I think something that kept me away from it was, I don't understand what order I'm supposed to watch it. I don't understand what this means. I don't care. And I do feel like that is an obstacle that a lot of these types of genre films run into when, mm-hmm. when they are being retouched up or redone, or no, disregard this trilogy and only pay attention to this trilogy, or disregard this movie and only pay attention to this. Should I have watched episode 25 and 26? Because really, technically, this is episode 25 and 26. Those kinds of things are weird and it's hard. And as a completionist, it drives me crazy. And I say, okay, great, I give up on that. But I do think that I'm very happy that I sat down and watched this, and that you pretty much made me watch. You pretty much strapped me to a chair and said, you don't have a choice. Yep. I'll see you on Thursday night. But I am happy that I did that, because this was something where I would have just said, yep, don't get it. Not going to watch it. Not worth it.
Well, and like, that's the interesting thing with this rebuild that Anno made after the fact, when he like was given a budget and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's called a rebuild, and the first movie really does just recount the events of the anime with mm-hmm. like very almost no deviation whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But it technically takes place after what we just watched.
Gotcha.
There's like timey-wimey stuff in the Evangelion universe weird. Where everything kind of loops over and stuff. It's not worth trying to figure out because it's very confusing. But there are lots of videos you can watch on it. But the thing that really comes to is, like, I love that aspect of this too, where the big thing with End of Evangelion is it does have a bit of a difference to the original ending. Because in the original ending, we really see Shinji get to this point where he is accepting of himself as an individual, something that we hadn't seen at all through the series. And like, mm-hmm. that's when we get like that final scene in the anime, right? The congratulations scene is when Shinji finally realizes, oh, I can learn to love myself. Mm-hmm. And that is, it's antithesized in End of Evangelion, where instead of learning to love himself, Shinji accepts the pain of life. Mm-hmm. And it's brilliant. The last scene of this film is so good. Just of Shinji finally like getting his body back and just rolling over and choking Asuka as Asuka just reaches up and like gives him affection, mm-hmm. which is something he has almost never had.
Yeah,
it's such a beautiful and poignant moment that just, I think, encapsulates everything that makes Ava so good.
Yeah. No, and I really enjoyed that. And I definitely enjoyed the acceptance of humanity / pain and all of that stuff more than the ending of the movie. And I thought it was just better done, that decision of, no, it's okay. I'm willing to give all of this up to continue on. And we get into that like post-apocalyptic world, kind of the same decision that one scene guy gets, one episode guy gets, whatever, whoever's the important character. What's his name?
Guarv.
Yeah, that Guarv. Guy. Yeah. So kind of like him, where he's making that decision of, if I need to die so that all of humanity continue on, I'd rather that. And we see that so often in the science fiction genre, right? Like people putting humanity above themselves and saying, okay, Interstellar, which we watched a couple of weeks ago, is all about that. I'm willing to give up my life, my family, everything, so that I can try to make sure that humanity continues on. And I think that was that it earns that ending, though. A lot of movies don't earn necessarily that ending. I feel like Ava definitely earns that ending, and everything that Shinji gets from it, Asuka and everything like that. It definitely earns it. And I love that we just are sitting there with a giant half face of what's her name? Just watching them.
Of Rey, forever. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's there's so many haunting images in this film. And I think of like, there are things that just, there are images in this film that stick with you. It's like that closing shot. It's that face of Rey. It's like Quaru coming out of Rey to touch Shinji to like start instrumentality. It's, I mean, even think like Shinji's like semen covered hand at the beginning of this film
yeah.
makes him like one of the most despicable characters ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, you see what's so great about End of Evangelion is that it, every single character is at their absolute lowest at the beginning of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Shinji is just hates himself more than he's ever hated himself. Asuka's pretty much like comatose because she can't mm-hmm. synchronize with Eva 2. Gendo's always the worst because he's a terrible human being. Masato is reeling from the death of Kaji, and everything she knows in the world is just crumbling around her. Ryutsuki is just like coming to terms with the fact that, you know, the world sucks and instrumentality is going to happen. Everyone's so low. And Anno takes his time to make it so that these characters may or may not get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a huge reflection on depression and how it hits every one of these characters differently. It's so beautiful. And it really goes to show Anno's understanding of each of these characters and how they manifest just their darkest moments.
So I'm going to ask a kind of different question based off of just how you said they're all starting at their lowest, right? So this is the second movie that you have that is actually like a continuation of a show. Cause even though Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me is a prequel, it's still, you know, it's a continuation of the show. Do you feel that a movie like this, and obviously it's your number 20 right now, is almost at an unfair advantage and disadvantage when it's coming on the heels of something? You've already done the legwork to let us know who these characters are, but then you're also not going to be able to find an audience outside of the people who've already watched this, right? We saw that with Serenity after Firefly, which is the biggest steaming pile of shit of all time. I don't care what anybody says. Firefly is the worst TV show ever created. And I've seen a lot of bad TV shows, but I hate Firefly. But when we sit down and you look at this, is that like Evangelion, if it wasn't for the show, if you just sat down and watched this movie, is it possible to even just properly say, okay, this is what this movie is, or is it just impossible because of what else came? And do you think that somebody could actually sit down and watch this movie and enjoy it if they didn't know what the hell an Evangelion was?
I think the structure of this film is strong enough to support itself on its own. Mm-hmm. I think it still gives us that beginning, middle, end. Yes, we have these characters, but like we learn about these characters a lot in these first moments. Yeah, you might be a little confused because like it is jumping in off of this like 24 episode arc of the show. But I think each of the characters are still portrayed in a way where you really clearly understand what each of their roles are very quickly in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do agree with that. I almost wonder if somebody just plopped down and watched it. I think that would be like a fun experiment because I feel like it starts off and they're just in a fight. And you might not know who these characters are, but it doesn't take long to figure out who they are. I don't think it would have the same impact of like Misato's death or of Asuka screaming for mommy and things like that. But I do think that you could pick up on it and get it. But I always struggle with this kind of thing because what the Community thing was, what, six seasons in a movie? Is that what they always made the joke of or something like that? It's hard because we even saw with the Many Saints of Newark, as popular as The Sopranos was, nobody gave a shit about the movie. Nobody saw it. It didn't get that good of reviews. It was like very okay. It was past its time. And people who hadn't watched The Sopranos weren't going to go see The Many Saints of Newark because you hadn't seen The Sopranos. Yeah. So I always find it very interesting when these types of shows – or when these types of movies get made and they really are just built off of a show, especially one that's as niche as Evangelion is.
Yeah, it's a really good question. But I mean, it's kind of the same as like, does a sequel stand alone, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have a couple of sequels in our top 100 and the ones that we do have are the ones that are able to stand on their own.
But do we have any sequels where we don't have the first movie in that series?
I had Empire Strikes Back and I had whatchamacallit?
I don't know. Oh, 10 Cloverfield Lane, but that's not really a sequel, is it?
No, not that one.
The Last Jedi.
One that I can't remember. I also had The Last Jedi, but And then, like, you had...
You had Last Crusade. Yeah.
Yeah, I had Last Crusade. You had Before Sunset.
That's true. And I didn't have Sunrise. Okay. So that's fair then. That's fair. So it's kind of just looking at it that way, except I had to spend 12 hours of my life building up to the sequel.
Yes. Exactly. Instead of the hour and a half. But it's really interesting. And again, it comes down to Evangelion as a whole. And like the reason this movie hits so high for me is because it hit me at that right moment. Mm-hmm. And every time I revisit it, I just feel like a stronger person afterwards. Mm-hmm. Like, I watched Good Will Hunting before End of Evangelion. Let me tell you, for movies with like similar themes, you should watch Good Will Hunting afterwards, because End of Evangelion just makes you really depressed afterwards.
Yeah, it really does. And I watched Evangelion, and then I did nothing. That was what I watched that on Tuesday. So yeah, I really did just like kind of hang out after that. But it was good because I watched the 6-episode build up to that the day before. So I had finished the series, watched all 6 episodes at one time, and then sat down and watched the movie. But yeah, it is funny, movies that are so similar in theme, how they can hit in such different ways. But now that we're into our top 20, it'd be really surprising if we didn't talk about movies that were hitting us at the right time in our lives and how they impact. And what I'm enjoying so much about going through this list right now is really, as I watch these movies that are coming up on this part of my list, is seeing why they resonate so much with me, right? Like when I'm watching Good Will Hunting, I remember sitting down watching that when I was 14 years old, living in my small ass town, not being happy with where I was, wanting to get out, wanting to do something more. Everybody telling me how, you know, you're too good for this place. And it's like, okay, but what does that mean? Like, what does that mean? And how does that make me feel better or worse or whatever? It's fun to sit down and watch these movies. And when you watch them in order, it really does show to me there is such a gap in my mind of like my number 30 of Little Miss Sunshine and my number 31 of Rosemary's Baby. Because as much as I love Rosemary's Baby, Little Miss Sunshine on, there is such a gap in what those movies mean to me. And when I sit down and watch these, my top 30, I really say to myself, okay, if I find 70 more movies that make me feel like these 30 movies make me feel, I will have a pure top 100. And I don't have that yet. And that doesn't take away from my other 100, the other 70 movies in my top 100. But I think that's, you know, when you're talking about Evangelion, how will something ever hit you in that way again? And when it does, now you know that the movie you're cutting out of your top 100 deserves to be cut out of your top 100.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We are at that point. We're at that point where like these movies, as we get down, you're seeing older movies, you're seeing movies that we saw when we were younger, and just like these ones that have very monumental moments attached to them for us. And Evangelion just does that in a way where, yeah, this movie makes me utterly depressed. I have like an existential crisis every time I watch End of Evangelion, but I almost welcome it because it just makes me so reflective on how far I've come at the same time. And just that idea of like even instrumentality, it has this, the concept of the Human Instrumentality Project has this idea wrapped around it that it's easier for us if we're all just one being to connect with people. And it's so hard for us to connect with people because of our AT fields that we're putting up and we're just kind of rejecting people and all the time. But seeing that visualized as, you know, everyone, the sequence where Ghost Ray comes out and everyone just starts turning to LCL, haunting, absolutely haunting, some terrifying imagery in there. And you just think, how could I ever think that is better than what I'm going through now?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of what we're going through now, John, why don't we move on and talk about the best movies you watched?
Yeah, this week? I mean, I guess it's 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's true.
Because we did take last week off while I went to Twin Peaks.
Yes. John finally got to experience life.
Yes. What a fantastic experience that was, I tell you. That was a phenomenal thing to do. Go to the filming locations of your favorite things, guys. It's just feels great. Like, I was smiling all day when I did that. But I rewatched a couple of movies that we had covered in our top 100. I watched Before Sunset, which obviously is probably like overall the best movie I watched this week. But I think, like, if I'm going with a movie we haven't discussed so far, I kind of just have to go with Moana.
Nice. I love Moana.
It is. I hadn't watched it until you and Alexa covered it that first time when you were doing the Disney movie watch. And I did love it then, but I finally got around to watching it a second time. And it is such a well-constructed Disney movie. And it really just makes you think, it makes it very clear why Disney keeps trying to recapture that. And like, why every Disney movie now is just like Moana retold. But you just can't beat that movie. It is so well done.
Yeah, a movie like Moana really lets you see how bad a movie like Encanto is. Like, Encanto's terrible. I don't care what anybody says. Encanto's a bad, it's a half of a movie. It's not even a full movie. Yeah. It just ends. It's here it is and it's over. And Encanto's not a good movie. The songs aren't that good. We don't talk about Bruno's only popular because it was a TikTok sensation. If it wasn't for that, it would be nothing. But a movie like Moana just nails it from top to bottom. Lin-Manuel Miranda just like really firing on all cylinders with that one. And really, like, Maui is such a great character. Such a great freaking character.
Very good.
Mine I watched today, and I think, John, you had talked about this one earlier in the podcast as one of your best movies of a week. I watched M for the first time since I was like 16 years old, and holy shit, man. That is like, that was one where as I was watching, I was like, this might fit into what I was just talking about with that top 30 with that feeling and everything. God, this movie, it's amazing to think that it's 91 years old. Like, it can't even eat off like the senior menu anymore because it's too old to have teeth. And yet it is so perfectly crafted. It is just such a perfect. I don't know if we've ever seen a movie achieve what this movie achieves. And it's 91 years old.
Yeah.
The fact that we know who the killer is the entire time, and you know that the townspeople and the police are going to try to find him. That scene where all of the criminals are sitting around and they start to hatch their plan because he's impacting their business. Oh my, it just takes that movie on such a different excursion than you thought it was going to go. And the ending is absolutely haunting. And yeah, I bought that when Criterion did their flash sale, and I love it, man. I really do. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah. I mean, there's no part of that movie. Like, Fritz Lang just kills it. The entire film, everything he does in that film, he crafts this like haunting narrative. The use of In the Hall of the Mountain King is terrifying. And you're just rooting against this character so much that, like, these, like you said, the criminals are all planning everything. You're just like, yes, go do that because this person is despicable. And it keeps you enthralled the entire run of the movie.
I love, one of my favorite parts of the whole thing is at the very end when they're doing everything and they're like, if you willingly kill this person, blah, blah, blah. And the guy stands up and says, all right, well, the person who just accused you, who I believe is wanted for 3 counts of manslaughter. Oh, that's not relevant here. And it just, it's that, oh my God, Peter Lorre's character is so despicable, but so is everybody else. And I think that's why that last line is one of the most iconic last lines, where it's like, we all need to watch our children, all of us, or something like that, whatever the woman says. It's so iconic because it is just haunting. It doesn't matter what the verdict is, whether he's seen as insane or found guilty. Everybody's kind of responsible. And back in these, you know, it's hard to maybe grasp that now in 2022, right? Because we don't really live in these small towns anymore. Everything is, we have our phones, we can reach out, we can do whatever. But it really captures that small town feel of, how did we all let this happen? We all had a part in letting this happen. But yeah, the chalk on the hand is just, it's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good. All right. Anyway,
classic. You have to see it.
It's a classic, 1931. And it might be the second best movie of that year because City Lights came out that year. Like, that year, if you're talking 30s, that's the year to sit down and watch two movies, because City Lights and M just stand the test of time. They are brilliant. All right, the next movie from 1997 for tonight. So we're talking Good Will Hunting, which is my number 20. And as I've already kind of hinted at, the thing with Good Will Hunting, so I find Good Will Hunting is lucky to be in my top 20, right? Like, and I mean that, like, Gus Van Sant should be writing me letters every Christmas to thank me for keeping this in my top 100. But if you really think about it this way, right? Matt Damon and Ben Affleck really weren't in that many good movies. They get a lot of credit for being like these like icons and everything like that. They're not in that many good movies. I think The Departed is pretty overrated, even though I like it. And you know, the Bourne movies are fun, and The Martian is pretty good. I obviously love Shakespeare in Love, but Ben Affleck is far from the star of that movie. But this threw them onto the map. And the thing with this movie is, Gus Van Sant really never went on to have this type of success again. Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, in my opinion, never were in another movie that comes anywhere near this movie. Robin Williams doesn't really blow up to the level that everybody thought he would blow up after his Oscar-winning performance. Minnie Driver pretty much falls off the face of the earth in just the Studio Ghibli English dubs. And that's really what this movie is. Stellan Skarsgård, he's not the most successful because, let's be real, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon were more successful. But Stellan Skarsgård probably was the best actor after all of this, like, who took on the best projects and is a part of the best movies. But this movie, for all the corniness that's in this, because there's a lot of cheesy, the apples line, which is so good, is also so corny. And like, there's so many cheese ball moments in this movie, but it just so perfectly captures the lost feeling of early 20s, and you're being pulled in these different directions that nobody in the world can understand. Now, it takes this to the extreme, and it makes him a brilliant person who's from an orphanage whose best friends are all alcoholics and work construction, and they all live in South Boston, and he works at MIT. So it takes it to all these extremes. But if you remove the extremes, what this movie really is just, I am at that moment where I am making the decision of how the rest of my life is going to unfold. Am I going to reach my potential? Am I going to fail to reach my potential and willingly not do it? Or am I going to fail to reach my potential and be able to live with that? Those are the three choices in this movie. And it so masterfully captures that feeling of, but I just want to be around my friends who would do anything for me. And you're asking me to step out into this world where nobody gives a shit about me and nobody knows what I've been through. And you expect me to just go out there and willingly put myself out there and remove myself from this safety. And yet that's what we ask people to do every single day. And I feel Good Will Hunting just captures that so much better than other movies that came after it that really tried to just replicate what Good Will Hunting did. Watched this movie when I was in high school, blew me away. Watched it numerous times when I was in high school. Then I watch it in college, it blows me away. And now I watch it when I'm 30 and I'm a little bit more settled into my life. And still I say to myself, okay, but could I be doing more? Am I reaching that potential? Could there be more to life that I need to be achieving? And when a movie can make you feel and think that way, at three very different parts of your life, when you're a teenager, when you're in college, when you're, you know, married and have a house, it's a very, those, that's a powerful, 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 powerful movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's okay. I have not watched Good Will Hunting until this week.
John, you are getting booted.
I kept this one secret from you because I knew I'd get flack for it.
You're going to get flack. Now you're going to get more.
I know. But this is different. This isn't one of those movies that I like just like flew under my radar. I've known about this movie since probably 1997.
Yeah.
This is a movie I was a little scared to watch it because I felt it wouldn't live up to the hype and that I'd be really low on it. And people would be like, how can you not like Good Will Hunting? And I'm very glad to report that is not the case after I watched this movie. This movie is really well done and it's impressive what Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were able to do with this movie and write this script that is so much about potential and accepting potential, realizing potential, but it also has this like commentary on intellectualism and its place in society, which I don't think ever really gets talked about. I texted you while I watched this movie. It's like, how did I, like, no one talks about Stellan Skarsgård in this movie.
No. That is a miserable character. That is an absolutely miserable character.
Absolutely. But he does a phenomenal performance in this film, and no one talks about it because there's so much more to talk about, which was absolutely phenomenal in this film.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy what they're able to pull off. And it's funny you say that because Good Will Hunting to me is a movie that shouldn't work, right? Like, you think about a lot of these classics, right? If you were to go down the AFI or BFI list and all that, and BFI just came out with a new list. So if you want to go read a new list, they have a new top movie because they have to be pretentious schmucks instead of just putting Citizen Kane there every time, right, John? But so when you look at some of those movies, right, you have like your Casablanca's and your Godfather and that, and then you get your Wizard of Oz, which is kind of hit or miss for people now, right? Because it doesn't work for some people anymore when it's the first time they're watching, but they didn't grow up with it. Now they're 35 years old and they're sitting down to watch it and they say, I don't get it. What's so good about that? Same way somebody who's 35 years old and had never seen a Star Wars movie probably isn't going to like Star Wars very much because they're not going to get what the hype is. Good Will Hunting shouldn't work as well as it does. But this is why I always say a movie like You Were Never Really Here, is that what it is, with Joaquin Phoenix and the little girl?
Yeah, it is.
And yeah, and you love that movie, and I don't. But here's my thing, and here's my problem. When you start to look at the new school independent film, it's how can I take my $1 million camera and make everything look as good as possible and have a character who barely talks and have a story that's really convoluted and whatever. And I always say that I will take the 80s and 90s indie film craze and the early 2000s, because I'd bring Charlie Kaufman into that for sure, over anything from 2007 on. Because once really No Country for Old Men came out, everybody thought, oh, good, we can make, and we're talking about No Country for Old Men next week. But once that movie came out, pretty much everybody said, oh, great, we can make a low budget, fun, whatever movie. But give me Reservoir Dogs. Give me Kicking and Screaming, the Noah Baumbach movie, where you can tell that they're not in the locations they say they're in. Give me Whit Stillman with Last Days of Disco and all that. And give me Good Will Hunting. Because at the end of the day, these movies are so relatable. This movie looks like shit half the time. I watched it on a DVD that wasn't formatted for my screen. I had a black box around the screen. Okay, so maybe that's part my fault, but it's also not. It's very low budget. The locations, everything like that, it's all very like matter of fact and natural lighting and everything like that. But the slow motion fight scene, like, come on. I mean, come on. You could have done better, Gus. But the story and the characters are absolute perfection. And I will take story and character over something that looks beautiful any day of the week. And that's why Good Will Hunting's my number 20, because it is perfection from a story and character standpoint.
Absolutely. And it's this character that feels so relatable for so many people. I think Will Hunting is just one of those characters that I think we kind of all know that person, right?
Yeah.
That person who like is really smart, isn't really reaching their potential, has no aspiration to reach their potential. But, you know, in the world of the 90s, and the early aughts, like this idea of external pressure to realize, to capitalize and realize your potential was so strong for this generation.
It was.
Like, I mean, I know it because I lived it. And like, it was just so indicative of this time frame. And to look at it now and to see Good Will Hunting the way it's framed, I think the scene at the end of the movie where Stellan Skarsgård and Robin Williams are talking, and Robin Williams' character just says, you always look down on me as if I didn't accomplish anything, but I am so happy with what I've done. That is just that moment that really hit home.
Oh, because,
where it's like, yeah. This is what I feel right now. Do I feel like I'm reaching my potential? No, I literally just talked about how I abandoned my dream job because I found out I didn't like it. And like, to have this validation of this Oscar-winning movie explain that so distinctly is just great. It feels, like I said, with End of Evangelion, I feel like a better human when I watch that movie. Feel like a better human after watching that scene and being able to reflect on myself and be like, yeah, I am happy with what I'm doing.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, I don't know if we're on a little bit of a delay, but it seemed like you were cutting a little bit there, but I got most of it. My thing is with this movie, so yes, I 100% agree with you. There was so much in the 90s and the pressures of us growing up. Because the thing was, you had the Depression, and then you had the people who were born after the Depression and after the war. And they wanted to be better off than their parents, but they didn't know how. They had no freaking clue. So then they have kids, and they want their kids to have a better life than them, but they don't know how to give that to their kids. And instead, they give their kids Vietnam. And then their kids, and I'm just talking about America, obviously, but that's what this is a, yeah. If you set a movie in Boston, you're making an American
movie. Yeah, it's an American movie.
And so you sit down, and then those kids who were born in the 60s and 70s say, okay, we're going to have a better life. We're going to find happiness. Our kids are going to be happy and whatever. And so what that meant was all the kids born in the 90s and early 2000s and I guess the late 80s were told, you are going to be better than what I am because I'm giving you opportunities that are going to make it so that you will be better than what I am. And that did not come across the right way. And I'm not saying that I don't believe in the participation trophy coddling bullshit. Okay. So I'm going to say that first, but I do think that by saying you can be better than what you are putting insane pressure on people because back in the day, if you go back to before the Depression, if you grew up somewhere, and that's why the Civil War was such a big thing in American history. If you grew up somewhere and it was bad, you didn't say, okay, I'm going to achieve more so I can get out of here. You said, I'm going to achieve more so I can take my community and make it a better community. How can I make the life? You didn't look to go away. You look to make the life of your family better, right? We see that a lot with the immigrants who came to New York. The reason that the mafia started was because they were trying to make their lives better and the lives of their families better than what they were. But they didn't want to leave New York. They didn't want to leave North Jersey. They wanted to be there. And Good Will Hunting gets into that of, okay, if you don't accomplish the highest potential you can, does that mean that your life as a whole was just a failure? And the scene that everybody talks about in this movie is the home run scene. Robin Williams won the Oscar predominantly because of this scene. I mean, he's phenomenal in the whole movie, but this scene blows people away. It's amazing. The whole story about meeting the wife and all of that and blah, blah, blah. But the one that gets me and that I have quoted to myself, you know, you're in the shower and you've had a bad day and you're like, all right, how am I going to get through this? How am I going to get through this? The one that has gotten me since the moment I watched this movie when I was like 14, 15 years old is the Ben Affleck, Matt Damon scene at the construction site.
Yeah.
That to me is one of the best film scenes, one of the best written scenes in film history. To me, that's on the level of Judd Hirsch with Timothy Hutton and Ordinary People. What did you do wrong? What did you do wrong? You held on. He wasn't strong enough to hold on, but you held on. It's up there with that where that's the realization for Will that even his friends aren't going to continue to be there for him if he doesn't take this chance. And the most frustrating thing for everybody in this movie and even for the viewers were we know that he has the winning lottery ticket. He's not worried about, will I ever get the winning lottery ticket? He has the winning lottery ticket. Now he just has to go cash it in. And that scene between him and Ben Affleck where his friend is telling him, if you're still sitting here and I'm picking you up and we're watching our kids play Little League and we're drinking and blah, 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 and that's all we're doing, I'm going to kill you. Like, I'm going to kill you because you might say, I didn't ask for this and all that, but you're the one who's actually able to achieve everything we've been told our whole lives that we'd be able to achieve. So go do it and get the hell out of this and come back to it and visit it and help do better for us Because if you go become better, then you can help us get out of the situation too. Tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be 50. And that's the, I think that was the biggest fear of that, of our generation. And I don't know what the Gen Z people are doing. I don't understand Gen Z people, but I think the biggest fear of people from our generation who were born in the late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s, whatever, is I'm going to wake up and my life is going to have passed me by and I am not going to have lived up to my potential. And I think that's why there's so many people on antidepressants now and, like, you know, anti-anxiety medicine, because there is so much pressure from that. But what the thing that Good Will Hunting does is it does kind of do it with those, with the kind of kid gloves of, you didn't ask for it, but too effing bad. You got it. And you're that good. Get out of here. Go with the girl who loves you and is on the other side of the country. Take that chance and put yourself out there, because you have an opportunity that other people don't have. But it's not the fake opportunity that we're all told that we all had just because we were born.
Yeah, and it's that really interesting framing of it where Will is so self-deprecating and just self-destructive in the film, because he sees the results of everyone who's been told that they have this potential and it all falling around him. Mm-hmm. He isolates himself in order to prevent himself from getting hurt. I mean, he's been through multiple, like it's explained through the film, right? He's been through multiple foster homes, some of them being sexually abused and physically abused at them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, he's trying to cocoon himself. And this is kind of that result of everyone telling us, you have so much potential, you have so much potential. Because the biggest problem we have with this film the biggest thing this film is showing is Stellan Skarsgård's character sees the potential in Will and sees him as a better him.
Yeah.
And he's pushing his ideals onto Will. That's why Sean, Robin Williams' character, is so supportive and is just such a fantastic mentor in this movie, because he, in the end, really just cares about what Will wants, but also isn't willing to condemn him to a life of fear.
Yeah. Well, and I think what Stellan Skarsgård's character shows too is there's so many people who want something so badly, right? Like, we all want this like version of immortality. We're talking about this with the ghost story and Blue Valentine. Like, what is it? What do we want? How are we going to get it? You know, and we see that in this movie where Sean says to him, what do you want? I ask you a simple question and you can't answer it. And you know, that's like when they have their little tiff over the shepherd, which is hilarious. But it's like Skarsgård's character has achieved everything he wanted, right? He's a mathematician. He's solved all these problems. He won his Fields Medal. He feels like he's better than everybody, but he's teaching at MIT. That's all he's just teaching. And that he might still be satisfied with that, but he feels that if somebody else isn't living up to their potential, he starts taking it out on them because he knows he maybe didn't live completely up to his potential. But even if he did completely live up to his potential, he's still not content and still not happy with the person that he is and the person that he is becoming and the person that he's going to be in the future. He still has his insecurities and the things that he doesn't like about himself and blah, 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 blah. And so it is that, you know, it's the quarterback father, right? I was going to be a quarterback and then I tore my ACL. Therefore, my son needs to be a quarterback and I'm going to just like pretty much abuse him until he's as good as I wanted him to be. And we see that trope all the time, except this time we're seeing it with a professor and with Matt Damon. And, you know, with Matt Damon's character saying, you know, I don't want to, you know how easy this is for me? I hate having to explain this. And that shot at the pride and the hubris and all of that. And that is so powerful in this movie because nobody where they are is happy, right? We have Minnie Driver's character who is miserable, like in her own way, even though she's trying to be happy. She's got a brutal past too. They all have some sort of brutal past and they're all trying to overcome something. And Will is the one who every single one of those characters can see themselves in. And that's why they're all pulling for him so much harder and pushing for him to go out and achieve something more. And it puts an unnecessary, unrealistic set of expectations on somebody who really isn't emotionally ready to handle them.
Yeah. And that brings up a very good point. Like, Will is not emotionally mature at his age, right? Like, he's we see him turn 21. He's not acting like a 21-year-old in this movie. He is acting like a teenager still. And part of that just has to do with his upbringing and the societies. And part of that, I think, is because he doesn't want to accept adulthood fully. But everyone puts all that pressure on him. It's so surprising to actually see him succeed at the end of this film because of how much pressure's on there. But a lot of it just comes down to Sean being like, hey, do your thing, and being so supportive of him while everyone's putting all that pressure on him.
Yeah, and I think that's why the Robin Williams character of Sean has really stood the test of time, right? I mean, it's really hard to watch this movie now knowing what ended up happening with Robin Williams at the end of his life, and to see this character as so supportive and caring and all that. And obviously, he's playing a character, right? Like, it's not really Robin Williams. But when you understand, like, the hurt that Robin Williams was going for 25 years ago, because he was. I mean, this was a guy who was always kind of struggling with demons and whatever. To see that and see the role that he plays and everything, I think that adds to kind of this Sean character. But Sean as a whole is just, it's a character we don't see in film, right? Like, that's such a hard character to pull off without making it feel sappy. And you can see the inspiration from Ordinary People on this movie. Ordinary People, which came out in 1980, 17 years before, but you can see the inspiration between Timothy Hutton and Judd Hirsch. It's just Robin Williams and Matt Damon in this movie. And instead of having a father figure to go back to, he's going back to Ben Affleck all the time. That's the difference in between these two movies. But it's the Robin Williams character is so well done. And we saw this character try to be duplicated so many times after Good Will Hunting. Running with Scissors was a movie that really tried to just like hammer home what the Good Will Hunting thing was. We even see it in a lot of Wes Anderson movies, right? Like, Wes Anderson is obviously heavily inspired by Good Will Hunting, and nobody's come close to this Robin Williams character because there's something so authentic about this Robin Williams character and how he tries to push Will and get out of Will what he needs to get out of Will. One of my favorite scenes from this movie is when Will tells the joke about the airplane. He's like, you never been on an airplane, have you? No. And then like 10 scenes later, Robin Williams is in the bar waiting for Stellan Skarsgård to show up. And he's telling that joke to the bartender.
Yeah.
Like, I love that because it's so freaking real. And I really do think like Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Casey Affleck, we saw Manchester by the Sea. We see it with Good Will Hunting. The Town even was a good example. Gone Baby Gone. They did such a good job of capturing the realism of these communities, right? Like these old Irish communities of this is what we have. And that really resonates with people. You don't necessarily have to be from that kind of town to understand what that type of I have your back is. Like when Sean says in this movie, no, he would lay down in front of a car for you. But that's different than what I'm asking you right now. And I think, you know, they had a really good way of just capturing those moments. And really, Van Sant just was way above his pay grade hitting this movie because he never even came close again after this.
Yeah. And I mean, Van Sant wasn't even the first director asked to direct this either, was he?
I don't know enough about it, to be honest with you.
I'm pretty sure Kevin Smith was asked to direct this first.
And Kevin Smith was a co-exec producer on it because he just didn't think he could. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you consider the fact that Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were already friends with Kevin Smith at the time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they brought the script to him, and he said, no, this is too good for me to direct. So the studio found another director and found Van Sant.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, Van Sant was obviously, he had made My Own Private Idaho. So he had some success, Drugstore Cowboy. This was kind of like the end for Van Sant because after he made this, he was almost too big for his britches, right? Like, he made Milk. I think Milk is super overrated. I think that's a very dry, bland, you know, just biopic. Elephant is okay. Paranoid Park is okay. Made the Psycho reboot, which was like flat out bad. Finding Forrester is okay. Like, he never just got back to this level. I wonder, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon never wrote a script again, right? There's always those theories that they didn't actually write it, that somebody else did it, that somebody else helped, blah, 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 blah. They just wanted to make stars out of Damon and Affleck. Whatever it was, it's so well done. And sometimes when you have the right creative people coming together at the right time, you just make perfection. And Good Will Hunting is a special movie. Good Will Hunting to me, and I know you don't like it, but Good Will Hunting to me feels like the Rocky of the 90s, where it really has no business working. Mm-hmm. And yet it is really such a generation defining movie. Like, yeah. You mentioned Good Will Hunting. You're not going to find people who don't like Good Will Hunting. You'd really struggle to find somebody who doesn't like Good Will Hunting, especially somebody who was born in the 80s or 90s. You'd really struggle to find somebody who doesn't like Good Will Hunting. You might find people who don't like Good Will Hunting now because they know the hype around it. But somebody born in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, I don't think that you'd find many people who don't like Good Will Hunting if they've seen it.
No, I think it just relates to that generation just so strongly. Yeah. And even like the more comedic scenes in the film, like, I bought into this movie with the Harvard bar scene. That's the point where I was like all in, because to see that like snot-nosed Harvard guy trying to flex his muscle, knowing that he's more educated than these people, and then seeing Will just like hand him his ass on a silver platter, phenomenal. And it is such a well-written scene. It's so well-paced that it gets you in, and it makes you realize that the most important part about that scene is this isn't just like Will Hunting is not some math savant. Mm-hmm. He's just an intellectual in general. And it's like I said when we first started talking about the movie, there's this idea of like intellectualism in society. And a lot of society thinks intellectualism is supposed to be reserved for these Harvard types.
Well, and I really love the look at the college education system, even in 1997, because remember, it was like around the Clinton era in America that it became everybody should go to college. That wasn't what it was like in the 70s and 80s. If you went to college, you were going to college because you weren't intellectual. You weren't going to college because, oh, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to go work as a mechanic somewhere or something. I just need to get my degree. Now you see people going and getting associate's degrees here in America who literally are getting nothing out of that associate's degree. So I love that it's looking at that as like, your brain is now worth $1.25 million. And what does that mean? Nothing. It doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. That's a really heady topic for 1997, because Clinton only came into office in 1992. So it wasn't like he had even been, you know, he was coming to the end of his run. He was in his second term, but this wasn't an idea that had been really ingrained in American society yet. That like we've seen now, where really college has just become this crazy money-making scheme, but that is, you know, neither here nor there. But Good Will Hunting is expressing that and showing that in 1997, how she's putting all this money and effort into this. And the guy at the bar is doing that too. And Will, with no education, but I think he says it to like, is it Robin Williams or is it that guy? But he's like, you're spending $250,000 on an education that you could get for $10 in a store. You know, you could just go read it for 10 bucks. Yeah. Yeah, at the library. Yeah, that's what it was. You could get it for $1.50 in late fees at the public library. That's what the line is. Yeah. It's so true, though, because nowadays that's the same thing. What are you going to college for? Are you going to college to party, or are you going to college to actually learn something to help you get a career? When I was in my master's program, they're telling me, oh, no. It's not about getting a job. It's about learning how to think. I'm spending a hell of a lot of money to not come out of this making money.
Yep.
So, but do you know – so, John, I don't know how – it works up there in ye old West, the northern states. But do you guys have the state? I don't know. Do you guys have the State Farm commercials? Have you seen the State Farm commercials?
I have seen State Farm commercials
with Mayhem, the guy Mayhem.
Oh, maybe not those ones.
You haven't seen the Mayhem ones? Look those up. Google those. But anyway, anybody who's in America will know the Mayhem commercials, where, you know, I'm Mayhem. You know, I'm at your wedding, and. You know, if you don't have the right insurance, then you could be like me. And he always breaks things and destroys things. That's Dean Winters. His brother, Scott William Winters, plays the Harvard prick in this bar scene. The two of them are both in Oz as the O'Reilly brothers, and they are phenomenal in Oz as the O'Reilly brothers. So I just always like to throw that out there, because neither one of them really did all that much in terms of like big time movies, even though if you're in America, Dean Winters is a household face, even though you don't know his name. But the Mayhem guy, it's a great ad campaign that's been run for 15 years. But they were brothers, and it's so funny. Every time that scene comes on, I'm like, holy crap, that's Scott William Winters. There he is. Like, that's him. But I just wanted to throw that in there. But yeah, Good Will Hunting really brings up a lot of questions about classism and rich versus poor and, mm-hmm. you know, nature versus nurture and changing versus, you know, stagnation and all that stuff. It really brings up a lot of heavy, heavy, heavy questions. And, you know, it's hard. I mean, I didn't grow up poor by any means, but it's hard when you know, I moved to California from my town and all of a sudden you're around people who are, you know, their families are worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Oh, you start saying to yourself, I don't really know how to interact with you, or like, do I have to act differently around you, or can I just be myself? Good Will Hunting gets into that. And it's 25. John, you had mentioned this week it turned 25 years old. Like on Friday, it's 25 years old. It's wild to think that it's that old of a movie. It really is.
Not as wild as to think that this didn't win Best Picture in 1997 because it lost to Titanic.
It lost to Titanic, but 97, man. So Titanic shouldn't have won, but 97 was tough with LA Confidential and this. Boogie Nights wasn't even nominated. I forget what the other – I think the Full Monty was this year, maybe. Hang on. I got to look it up because now you got me. Did win Best Original Screenplay, though, and the and the win from Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, their speech at the end is like iconic. It's so good. It was the Full Monty, and As Good As It Gets. As Good As It Gets is also a pretty good movie. Those were the movies that were nominated for Best Picture. The problem is, John, and you know it because you were alive and I was alive, Titanic was culture in 1997. Yeah. Culture. You couldn't walk down the street without hearing people talking about Titanic. You could, like, yeah. I was 5 years old and people in my first grade class or kindergarten class, whatever it was, are talking about Titanic. Like what? Mm-hmm. Like Titanic was unable to be gotten away from. And I think that's just, there was no way that it wasn't going to win Best Picture that year, even if every other movie that was nominated for Best Picture was better than it, especially LA Confidential and Good Will Hunting. Yeah, really brutal. But thank God Good Will Hunting. Well, Good Will Hunting wins Best Screenplay and it beats Boogie Nights, which is so tough. But God, it's a great year for movies. Like it really is. And I think it's an underrated year for movies because if you just scroll real quick and you look at, okay, what won Best Picture? You see Titanic. And I don't dislike Titanic. That's the thing. I do like Titanic. Titanic's just like, it didn't deserve the credit it got. Yeah. The second half of Titanic is pretty epic, even if the first half is insanely boring. But it just, you know, if you're quick scrolling, you don't really look through, okay, what other movies came out in 97? It's a hell of a year for movies. It really is a hell of a year for me. I mean, I have three of the movies in my top 25. I have three in my top 25, and you have Evangelion, which is 1997, right there.
I do.
At the same level as Good Will Hunting.
It's a good year for movies.
Yeah, great year. You have anything else about Good Will Hunting, or should we wrap this up?
No, I think we need to wrap up.
Good, because it's a long podcast. All right, next week we go into the teens. We're at number 19, and next week's a fun one. I'm really excited for next week. We have No Country for Old Men for John from 2007 and Pulp Fiction from 1994 for me. That is going to be a fun one because we have two auteurs, probably with their best well-known movies. Coming up here and I'm really excited to do that podcast together. That's a good one. Pulp Fiction and No Country for Old Men. So really looking forward to that. 19 episodes left. That's it. John, I guess we're going to have to do an end of year wrap up like we did last year, aren't we?
Yeah, we definitely have to.
Yeah. So we'll be doing that probably the last week of December. So we'll figure all that out and we'll get that going. But I didn't watch nearly as many movies as last year. John, you started off on a hot streak, but I think you've cooled a little bit. But either way, thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed this one. If you haven't seen these movies, make sure to check them out. We really are into the creme de la creme, if you will. And we'll see you next week when we talk about No Country for Old Men and Pulp Fiction.